Mark Kretzmann, the session is entitled Why Toshio Can Read Better Than Johnny. These 55 minutes or hours go so quickly that I'm a little hesitant to do it, but I have a chance with some people here who have an interest in Japan and things Japanese that I'm going to take out 5 minutes. Japanese is such an easy language to pronounce. It's really a shame to sort of go through life and make mistakes. Even I don't speak any Spanish, but still I know, you know, how to pronounce the Spanish J. Or when I used to have an old Toyota Corolla and take it into a Hispanic shop to get repaired, and they would call it the Corolla. So those kind of things make sense. In the same way in Japanese, it's so easy that you can take this home with you and you will never make another mistake again. 99%. Five vowels, just like Spanish. Again, I don't know, but I think it is. A-E-I-O-U. And they're all pronounced the same every time they come up, which is the great, what makes it so much easier than English. I just made this up when I came in here. To get all five of the vowels, O, Fuji, Sake. Fuji is Mount Fuji, and sake is the rice wine. And the vowels are pronounced like this every time you see them. Okay, the sake. You shouldn't say sake, because that would be an I, but it's a sake. Another example is Abe Sumiko. Actually, last night, too, I married her because she had all the vowels in her name. I put this up here just because the five vowels are A, E, I, O, U. One of them is not a Y, so that if you... It really doesn't matter, but it's more correct to say Tokyo. In other words, K-Y, that's a consonant, rather than Tokyo or Kyoto. The real way would be Kyoto, Tokyo. So there's the five vowels. Now all we've got left is the consonants. And the consonants always go with a vowel, except when a vowel is by itself. For example, there's one symbol for ka, K-A. There's one symbol for ke, K-E. Ki, ho, ku. They're all just one symbol makes that. The only exception is, as Pastor Nakamura pointed out in his address, service, is N. N is the only letter that can end a syllable, or can end a word, the only consonant. Okay? He gave the example of Nissan, which is a very good one. Another one would be Honda, because you have H-O, and then there's an N, and then there's a D-A. Anyway, any Japanese word you would break up into syllables. Okay, here's your test. We read this, Ma, ku, do, na, nu, do. What does that mean?
McDonald's.
Very good. That's Matadonardo. Matadonardo. The golden arches. The golden arches here. That's McDonald's in Japan, and this is why it's so hard, you know, because they have to, in where you have two consonants together in English, they feel compelled to put their vowels in there. So when you hear someone in Japanese say very good do, because you can't end the word in a D sound, they have to stick they use this one instead, they stick an O on there. The longer Japanese learn English, the better they get at sort of dropping that last one, but it's still very, very difficult to do. I'm glad Mr. Nakamura is here. The only other, one more thing, is the Japanese R. I don't know whether I quite agree with Mr. Nakamura that it's an L, because it's really neither an R nor an L. What it is, the people who study these things say it's a single labial. It's a single labial, and it's not unknown in English, but it's pretty rare. What it is the sound you make when you say Betty. Not when you say Betty, but when you just speak normally and say Betty. D. And for example, Mr. Pastor Nakamura's name has an R-A at the end of it. You would say Nakamura. Very quickly, your tongue hits your upper just once. But if you remember Betty, you can go home and practice that. That's the R. I'm all done here. Except the only other thing you could say is that, oh, just a real interest. Somebody told me a little while ago that when children grow up, and I'm not an expert in this, they begin by, first of all, the human speech sort of sounds the same, or it's hard to differentiate, doesn't sound the same, but they learn to differentiate in stages. And the first two consonants they learn to distinguish are M and P. And that is why they say in many languages of the world, not only in English, but in others as well, very often the words for mother and father, mama, papa, have those two consonants, because this is one of the very first that the child can distinguish. At the other end of the extreme is L and R, and that as even American kids grow up, the L and R is one of the last pairs of consonants that they learn to distinguish, hearing, and then correspondingly speaking. What happens in Japanese is that never happens. There is never the distinction between the L and the R, so that when, especially when Japanese become adults and then start to learn English, it's very, very difficult for them, and of course, you know, it causes a lot of trouble. Professor Moy did some great exercises, I guess, to learn that later in life. The last one here is Saskatchewan. And the only other thing, this wouldn't be a mistake, but the only other thing I want to say is about intonation and accent. If you said Saskatchewan, someone might find it amusing. So in Japanese is a tonal language like Chinese. I believe in Mandarin there may be four different tones, and Cantonese is more, eight or nine. Well, Japanese only has two, basically. There is advantage to that and a disadvantage. The advantage is, of course, it's very simple, but the disadvantage, in a way, to people who try to learn Japanese is, since there's only two, it sounds very much like English stress. In other words, when I speak Japanese, my American accent consists of where the Japanese would have a high syllable and a low syllable, I automatically say the higher syllable louder, as in louder, louder. Whereas in Japanese, it should be the same volume, but just at a different pitch. That's what they mean by a tonal. But when you approach Japanese, there are some rules for, like, my wife's name, Sumiko. Many Americans might be tempted to say Sumiko. In fact, a lot of them do. But the rule here is try to make it straight. Sumiko. Just keep it on an even keel, and without going either way, and you're real safe. When you hear the Japanese say it, if you hear my wife say Sumiko, then you can sort of mimic that and take it from there. But it's hard to tell, you know, without really knowing where the... It's a little more complicated to find out where the accent goes, and because it's really not nice. Okay, that's it. Holden, here's my next one. I decided today, since I never got through my notes on the other day, I would put them on the board this time. There are lots of different ways to go at Japanese education, and I think we all have we've heard many different things. I decided to try this one. What if the Japanese Ministry of Education took over Holden Village? Okay, this is our premise here. I'm going to tell you what I think would happen. And then I want you to, as you listen, I want you to critique it. I want you to tell me what you think basically what I want you to tell me is what you think we'd be losing in the process. Okay, I'm going to tell you how the Ministry of Education might approach this, and maybe some of the reasons why they do that. And I think by extension, you'll see why, in some ways, why the Japanese education system is successful, but also where its weaknesses are. We would come in here, I'm the Ministry of Education now, and I don't know how the place was acquired, but we would certainly want to use it for experiential and educational purposes for an optimum number of people. We don't want to overcrowd the place, but we want to get as many of our people through have the give them the opportunity to experience Holden, and we want to make it as informative and as enjoyable as possible. One of the first things we would do would be to form a committee of experts. And those experts might be many of you sitting in this room. People especially who have come to Holden year after year and have really done and tried what we would think is virtually the whole range of activities, arts, crafts. They've gone to Holden Lake, they've gone hiking this way, they've camped overnight there, they've fished here, they've done the pottery, they've done the lapidary, and all that. We would gather that group and say, well, then we would decide upon a time frame, perhaps a week. But okay, so we're going to run people through here on a week. Now, how do we, for the first time, and it'll probably come out, you want to standardize, you want to systemize this. And our idea is that when people come through, even though there's sort of an extensive orientation and such like that, that when they're new here, they really don't know what they want to do. They really don't know how best to utilize everything here. And with our help, with your help here, we can set up the system so that they can get the optimum experience in 1 week. And what we'll do, we'll set up this on Monday, we do this and do this, and we'll refine it, okay? Teenagers, we'll set up a teenage program. Young adults in their 20s will have something that's geared towards them. Little older people in 40s and 50s will do that too. We'll gear it to the weather if on a certain day the general plan for going outside or hiking is not feasible. We'll have an alternative for that, and this is the standardization. And the reason we're doing this is sort of what I just explained, but if we take 100 people here and send them through this program, we believe that the total enjoyment and the total amount, as well as the average satisfaction that the people will get out of that week, will be optimized. Okay? Rather than having a lesser system. That's very briefly the kind of thing that you could go in, you could, you know, play with that for a while. But how does that sound to you?
If it were Americans, it wouldn't work.
Very good. Yeah. Okay. What is this system assuming for? Yeah. Well, let's keep going.
Okay. It seems to me too regimented.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Too regimented.
I mean, you'd feel you have to do something every moment. Otherwise, you're wasting your time. No time for reflection.
It lacks spontaneity and choice.
Mm-hmm. I was going to say structured, which is a little bit different than what she was saying. Mm-hmm. Define the structure of what is outlined for you.
Okay, this is of course, you know, the response. What do you agree with me? Do you agree with the ministry in that, in a sense, this is the best way to maintain the highest average level of satisfaction for the people who come?
The people who come are all alike. Some people would hate what other people would love.
Right.
Can I ask one question? Would one be required to attend all this? Or would it just be available?
That's a good question.
Well, you know, we could work on it. We'll work something out. But this would be the standard fare. And I think we would try to encourage everyone to attend. I mean, you can have legitimate reasons for not attending. It sounds like Holden currently. Is it? Okay, there are a couple points. I'm not prepared to deal with that. A couple problems there. And one of the basic ones, of course, is the balance that you choose between the individual and the group, you know, in this whole thing. Every society and every sort of organization and institution makes that decision, cuts that line somewhere along the way. And I think when they talk about Japanese society being very group-oriented, what it's really saying is the Japanese have chosen, or at least the society as a whole has chosen, to cut it more over on the group side. I had a real stupid example. I was going, a couple weeks ago, I was riding the Clark Street bus from downtown to downtown Chicago for about 40 blocks. And I looked out, there wasn't much traffic. I couldn't, why is this thing going so slowly? Why does it take so long to get there? And I was comparing in my mind to Tokyo, which is often much more crowded, but somehow you seem to get there a lot faster. There are a couple of reasons. Streets are more narrow, so it looks like you're going faster. But other than that, and you look out the window, what happens on Clark Street, that bus stops every block. And sometimes if the block is a little longer, they have a stop in the middle of the block. And they stop everyone, one person gets on, they go to another block, one more person gets off, and stuff like that. So if you're coming to Clark Street and walking over there to catch the bus, what happens is you get there, and you don't have far to walk to get to the bus stop. Now, in Tokyo, there are some places where the bus stop is every four blocks. So when an individual comes and goes over to that cross street and wants to catch a bus, well, he might be lucky and hit one. At the worst, he's, two blocks away. I mean, if he happens to hit right in the middle of two bus stops, then he has to walk two blocks. Well, you know, that's where the Japanese decided to cut that line. They are requiring of each individual to walk that two blocks, extra two blocks, some of the time, or else to sort of make their schedule so that they don't have, you know what I mean? They have to adjust to that system. And they believe that this is, you know, it's sort of two similar systems where I think it's in a really, really small way you can see the differences between them. But again, it's the, I've got my bus stop story here. where do you draw the line between the responsibilities of the individual vis-a-vis the group? And if you think of in those terms, the way that Holden does it, you know, you're saying, right, some people might feel that they do it too much towards the group. If you think what I was saying reflects Holden as it is, you are obviously one of those people. But other, you know.
I don't mean that.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, you go to galleries and you go and look at you know, the possibility of people go to those. You know, very few people go to very many of those things.
But I got to be honest with you, I'm searching for one more thing, one more what people are starting to see as a defect about either in terms of Holden or just in general, about the program that we set up with Ministry of Education. We come in and talk to all you people and we get the best ideas and set up a program based on that.
Well, you're aiming for an average, and what are you doing for the one or two people who might perhaps surpass it? Here, under the open circumstances, but under a thing, they'll never go above a certain level. You raise the bottom, but you also lower the top.
Exactly. And that's the sacrifice made in creativity. And back, we'll just shift here real easily over the education system itself. In 1982, the much vaunted Ron Yasu relationship between Ronald Reagan and Yasuhiro Nakasone. One of the first things they did was to decide to study each other's education systems. And the idea is that just as we are all, and maybe this is the reason why you are all sitting in this room tonight, just as the United States feels that, gee, we've got a lot to learn from the Japanese system in terms of really getting people to learn their basics and to keep them moving and to prepare them for some kind of a decent job in a more technologically oriented world. And we really have to get going on this. The Japanese, we're passing. The Japanese say that's their strong point, but they say that we're failing in creativity. We are, just as you said, the people on the top are being sacrificed for this level of efficiency. And we've been able to do this so far because in many, many important areas, Japan has relied on technology from the West, especially the United States, up until this point. And now all of a sudden they're at or ahead, and they feel that this kind of system that has brought them this far is not going to take them much further, that they'll have to start working. So I went around with a mission. It was sort of more business oriented, but it was the same kind of thing. How do you encourage creativity in people is what they're trying to find out. So that was one of the things. I'm gonna say the other thing is very closely related to this, is even though we may have put together in one for one good week the distillation of all our experiences here, and this is sort of included in what you, there are still things that no one here has done. There are still things to be discovered about Holden, new projects to do, and new ways of going about things. And if you take even our distillation of what we've done here, it's going to be very static. And again, here the creativity part comes in. There is no... Well, that's what I mean. Mr. Tonegawa, I'm sorry. Yes?
Well, this Japanese... ministry be able to change the times? Let's say in 50 years, people want different things. Will they have changed the program, or did they just keep it the same from one end?
They will change it. One of the advantages of this system is that it's very, very easily adjusted from the top. And just speaking generally about the ministry, Japanese Ministry of Education issues the last about every 8 years. The last one. They had one when I was teaching in 1981, and I think they just did one last year in 88. General guidelines for all the schools. And these guidelines are very specific. Recently in the papers, what's come out is they've issued guidelines for the raising of the flag and the singing of the national anthem at school ceremonies. I mean, this has all been, sort of political fodder. But there's a lot more in those documents. They choose the courses, of course. They choose the textbooks. There may be a couple of textbooks, say, for 8th grade history, but everyone virtually studies the same thing all over the country at the same time. This is the system, I don't even know what this word is, systematization. They got a system. And think of some of the advantages of that, though. We're getting a little bit away from Holden. If you have a standardized system of education, that means that even though, for example, there's a little less mobility in Japan than there is here, but people move around quite a bit. If you take your kids and move from the southern island to the northern island, they jump right into the school. Chances are they'll have the same textbook. Chances are they'll be within 10 pages of where they were when they left school. Teachers can move around the country. I can go on and on with this, but what it is the same model of mass production that has made Japanese business so successful. They've taken things and their expertises in these production processes, smoothing it out, taking out the wrinkles, getting everything organized, and it's incredibly efficient. One other thing I wanted to say is, from the top down is, another advantage of the Monbusho, the Ministry of Education, doing something like that is, suppose these experts say that a hot topic comes up, like recently, superconductivity. And they say, our kids ought to be learning about this. Let's throw 2 weeks on superconductivity into, sophomore high school. The next time these things are updated, not every 8 years, they are constantly updated in something like this. All of a sudden, all over the country, you have this fine-tuning of this is what you're talking about, fine-tuning that every Japanese student is going to learn about superconductivity. Now, just think what happens in the United States on how those decisions are made all across the country on these local school districts.
You said every student learns. Actually, that's not true. Every teacher teaches it. Whether anybody learns it is another question.
Yeah, they have a failure rate. They call ochikobore, the people who just can't keep up. We were talking about this today. What happens is that they stay in the class, kids stay in the classroom and sit there and are don't come out of it with the same education as the other people do, and the Japanese consider that a real problem. But it's the cost of their system. You know, where they draw the line, they can't go down, or they can. They don't want to go down that far to get everyone. They want to keep, you know, that's a conscious decision at some level. I was with a guy who made construction robots a little while ago, and he said, it's getting very, very sophisticated, the computerization and the computer simulation. And he said, you know, they do a lot of construction in the mountains of Japan, roads. And he says, we have computer simulation, computer programs that will predict how many people will be killed in traffic accidents if we build this road. Because we feed into it the amount of traffic going through there and the number of rocks that fall down, the kind of thing, you know. And he says, and it's incredibly accurate. He said, we don't publicize that. I mean, how can the construction ministry publicize that? But we're going to build this road and 12 people will die. You know, they'll say, the public, and we as well, would want that down to zero, you know. But it happens in that construction that it'd just be too costly to go down to zero to make it that safe. You'd have to post guards there to watch for the falling rocks. Anyway, that's the sort of trade-offs you make. They can't go down and get all the kids, and they consider that a problem as well, you know. But it's a damn.
Yeah, I think with the, you know, yeah, I think the mass production model works very well, but you know, and you can make changes from the top, but the changes are within a limit until you get to the point where you have to retool and using the construction. I mean, like, mm-hmm. I work in the Holden Kitchen, I worked at McDonald's. McDonald's, we could crank out a lot of food a lot faster, but we can't make pizza without getting a whole new equipment in there. And what I saw with the Japanese school system, they can make these adjustments, like adding pickles, you know?
Yeah.
But they have a hard time, let's say they have English teachers that only know how to teach reading and writing, all of a sudden they want the kids to learn conversational English, they're in a big jam because they have all these teachers who only know how to teach reading and writing. And so they're trapped by that ability to retool.
Yeah, and I think they're almost coming into the decision now that it's time for retooling. As I was just saying, that this system has got them this far very successfully, and where do we go from here? And I think they're really grappling with a lot of these questions right now. Yeah.
What happens to special education kids? Where do they fit in? How do they fit in? What do they do with us? Learning disabled kids that are.
Severely disabled kids don't attend the public schools. They have other private facilities for them. The kids, I would imagine that part of you're talking about would fall into this category here of kids who come and just can't keep up.
They don't get any special help of any kind?
I'm not familiar with it. I'm sure they do. You know, there are efforts to be made at that. I'm sure they make efforts in that direction. And once again, it's not that they don't try in that area, it's just that compared to other systems, maybe, if we can do that, the line is drawn at a different area, you know, whether it's 12 people killed or one person killed or something like that. Kids who can sort of function in the classroom who might be falling, I'm sure they try as best they can to bring them along. Mandatory education, compulsory education runs through middle school. You have to go through ninth grade, but everybody goes to high school. You have anything else?
I'm done.
Are students passed on automatically?
Yes. There's very, very, very little failing.
The question I have is there, you know, they have sort of a standard level of education. Then what is the truth in that you hear, for instance, that even very young children have extra tutors and stay up at night studying? Is that to get above the norm? Or why is there such a competition?
The competition is, and this goes to some of the things we were saying before, which is, I mean, it's, there are so many ways to approach this, but of course the society itself places such a great emphasis on education that we brought up before, that the Japanese themselves believe their country to be very resource poor, and they believe very, very firmly that the only resource of their country is their people, and we have to agree with that. And education is the way for them to bring, until recently has been, to bring the country up from the ruins of World War II and to join the international community, which is very, very important to them. This has been a national purpose. I think that compared to other societies, the Japanese society is a little bit better capable of assuming a national purpose. I mean, that this is really a conscious, something that is conscious in the minds of virtually all the people. Or at least, a lot of the people. But one of the things that the competition, what you're referring to is the juku. And the juku are these, I don't even what, the, how did you explain it? They're the schoolwork, that's sort of the minimum. That's sort of the minimum. And what they do is over and beyond the schoolwork, they give you extra training to let you do very well on these famous entrance examinations upon which your future is determined. We were talking today that it has even gotten so, these juku have become so important that sometimes the role of juku in school really become reversed. In other words, we have relatives who study very hard at school so that they will be admitted to a famous night school, and the definition of famous being one that has a certain percentage of students trained who get into Tokyo University primarily, or Kyoto University. So these become very, very important. I put the little yen sign on the side because I wanted to also at some point bring up one little problem, and might as well do it now. These are very expensive schools now. And whereas the Japanese have prided themselves on an egalitarian system, which means that, you know, the ideal is that even if you're from a poor family, and if you study hard and do well on the various entrance examinations, you can get into Tokyo University and go on to a brilliant career. Well, the fact of the matter is that it's becoming almost essential that you attend one of these really high-powered juku. And it's essential that you have the money to pay for that. So what's happening is they found out now that a child raised in a family of the highest 20% of income has something like a 10 or 12 times better chance of getting into a good university than a poor child, which is sort of destroying their whole. It's not destroying it, but it's sort of perverting it in a sense. A word about the entrance examinations. Rain Man, I got it. Sumiko and I watched Rain Man, Dustin Hoffman, and of course he's sitting, he at one point in the movie, it turns out that the night before, he memorized the half of the telephone book, and we each turned to each other and said, this guy could get into Tokyo University. I mean, this guy would do well on the entrance examination, and we sort of roll with that, and she said, you know, a lot of the people that we know from Tokyo University have some of these few of these autistic characteristics. But yeah, that's what it is. You know, what are you? what are they studying? What are they studying? You know, I guess I don't want to really drill this on, because there is, of course, problem solving in the mathematics area and thinking through issues and stuff like that to an extent. But really, more than you would imagine, it is a matter of memorization. And these kids just sit down and actually memorize things. I wrote this character on the, this is the character for, it's in school, and it's the character for to learn something. It's pronounced Manabu, and they have, there's the standard theory among people who study the origin of words is that in the beginning it was related to manedu, which is to imitate. And the Japanese approach to learning is, in many cases, a case of imitation. For example, if you are, you know the game Go with the white and black stones? If you sit down and memorize a certain amount of games that the masters have played, or basic games, just memorize them, your rank goes up. In other words, you know, you don't have to become a good player in a sense like that. And I just talked to Sumiko's, I don't know very much about it, but Ikebana as well, you begin by just imitating the teacher's thing. Now, of course, that's not unheard of in the West as well. But there is a Japanese and an Eastern... I think sometimes we have a little, when we imitation, to imitate something for us, we are so individualistic that it's not always a good word. If anything, oh, he's just copying. I think, you know, copying is sort of a negative word. That isn't quite, the Japanese don't have quite the same idea of that. I mean, if you to imitate the master is not anything to be ashamed of. I mean, that's how people learn, is the idea. We'll back off it.
What is for the students studying so hard at the JUCOs, the normal school, what is their motivation? I mean, most American high school students, you know, if they're even asked to study that hard,
if you take the do well on the entrance examination and get into a good university, first of all, you don't have to worry about studying anymore. But this is the extreme case, but it's really true. There is very little of education compared to American universities, actually, that goes on in Japanese universities, the classic. Tokyo University, once you're in, you're in. The hard part is to get in, and then after 4 years, you graduate. You know, what it does is select out, what it does is this system takes high school kids, or maybe a little bit before that, and selects out those kids. Well, okay. Having sort of described a student who might be successful enough to get into Tokyo University, what kind of personality do you think?
Quiet, studious.
Quiet, studious, yeah.
Very accepting of authority.
Yeah.
Yes.
Obedient, conformist.
Yes, conformist. Discipline is a very good one.
Dependent.
Why do you say dependent?
Dependent on the family, wanting to get satisfaction from the family.
Right.
Dependent on parent expectations.
Yeah.
Highly motivated.
Highly motivated, yeah.
Loyalty.
To?
To the company.
Well, they're not in a company yet.
But
they will be.
Will be.
No, yeah, exactly, yeah. Right. Well, what you're describing is the ideal employee,
yeah,
for a Japanese company. And here, of course, I think you look at any country, and certainly you have to talk a lot about, and we've been doing it so far, the relationship between the education system and the economy. But the parallels in Japan, the association in Japan is so clear that what they are, persistence, you know, these guys have to study. There's a saying in Japan, too, if you sleep 5 hours a night, you fail. If you sleep 4 hours a night, you pass. Which means, you know, I mean, that's the cutoff. It's just a matter of how much you study, whether you can pass this test or not. There's another thing about that. It would go back to the, I think the Japanese have a very egalitarian sense of the possibilities of children as well. I mean, we all do, I'm sure. But in that, we throw in a lot of individual difference and such like that. The Japanese sometimes can be very clear about kids being this blank sheet of paper, and that any child, you know, this is their ideal. Any child you can teach, any child can learn, and it's just a matter of doing it. There's a lot to be said for that. Yeah.
No, what about men and women, boys and girls in this system? Do the same number get into universities? Are there cultural factors that would keep a girl from studying quite as hard at the juku? Or?
It's less than you think. And we've thought a lot about this, too. And when I taught in the Japanese school in Chicago, you know, I was sort of looking for things like that. And they do little things. The girls' names are listed alphabetically, separate from the boys, at sort of a gathering. The boys come in first, followed by the girls. There are things that obviously is a difference. Until recently, in high school, the girls took the equivalent of home economics, while the boys took some shop or stuff like that. They've now opened that up to the other sexes. But what's amazing is that there's not more of it when you look at what goes. And my sort of theory of now you take is that the rest of society has really made this gender separation so pervasive that when a young woman gets out of the university, that she'll work maybe up to 3 to 5, the standard pattern, 3 to 5 years at a company where she probably will meet her husband. Then she will leave the company to raise a family. And now perhaps after the children are a little older, she'll go back to work. While she's in the home, she takes care of the finances and becomes the minister of education in the household. In some ways, a very challenging roles. But the problem is that there's no choice about it, you know. But the thing is that after college, after the education system, those patterns are so set that there really isn't, and then also in the household as well, that the rest of society drives that home so hard that they don't have to really teach that in the schools. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. That it's surprising.
So girls do get into studying really hard.
Oh, yeah, sure.
Yeah.
I haven't heard that about that distinction in the Japanese culture. We live in the Skagit Valley, and there are several groups of Japanese students who come every summer, and that they maybe the pattern is repeated the country over, but they go to English school in the morning and have activities, kind of cultural conditioning or something in the afternoons. Those groups are nearly always high percentage of girls, like 30 girls to 6 boys. Mm-hmm. I've been puzzled why the Japanese parents are sending the girls over here in that kind of a ratio.
How old are they?
They generally between 14 and 16.
It may be that the boys are back home studying even harder.
They're in the youth.
In the juku. I don't know, it's hard to say. It depends on. It depends on how it's recruited in Japan and who you get over. The boys do the same thing. The other thing is that in the entrance examinations, English is one of the required subjects. So that the fact that they come over here, you know, it may mean, you know, that they're very, very serious about, they may be doing it so that to help them on the, explicitly on the English part of the...
Yes, it's clear that the students are here to work. Mm-hmm. You know, we thought of them as traveling, you know, they're doing this for, like, travel and broadening or something, but no, they have a clear goal of learning English, and they better not come home without it, I suspect.
We had, you know, the winners in this system, the winners, the people who who only sleep 4 hours a night or less and study this and have the ability to memorize this and do well in the exams and get into Tokyo University and become the managers of Japan. And I think managers is a really good word when you look at all these bureaucracies. These are real professional managers. These people are really bright. I mean, they're really bright people. Let me finish with this. But the brightness is an interesting kind of bright. They're very, very good at gathering information and also in sort of analyzing and sort of in organizing it. And here we go back to organization and systematization. And to finding the most efficient ways of doing things. This is a very efficient system. But the kinds of people they aren't is, for example, how could a concert pianist get into Tokyo University, right? I mean, you don't have time to be a good pianist and study for this entrance examination. You don't have time for anything out there. Other than this confined stuff. We had my niece, Sumiko's sister's daughter, she was 15 years old, she turned 16 when she was with us. Last September, she came from Tokyo and stayed with us in Poinet, Wisconsin for a year. And she was a sophomore at Poinet High School. And she did very well. Just blew them away. She had the highest math score. She, as a sophomore, had the highest math score in the entire school. And she took senior math. At Poinet, they teach geometry in sophomore year, and she'd already had that. And then, well, anyway, she took the senior class. And she was great. The problem is that she didn't want to do anything else. I mean, we pushed her into the JV basketball team, and we got her to do all sorts of things, but when it really wasn't related to her entrance examination and her career goals, she was very, very conservative and just lacked interest. And that was sad to see. That was sad to see. She just didn't have any of their outside interests because she just didn't have time for it in Japan. But the thing about this is, people are realizing, as I explain this kind of system, you and you would too, you feel that there must be people chafing under this system, and that's true. In fact, our niece's Sanae's parents were two of those people who said they watched her study all the way up until she was 15 years old, and they said, this can't be good for a 15-year-old girl to study like that. So they sent her to us, right? And we did the best we could.
It's to the tradespeople. How do they get their education, and do they get apprenticed into it, and do they still have to go through this scholastic discipline and rigmarole, or what?
There's much of the feudal system left in, you mean like building trades?
I think. Yes.
Yeah.
Or tradespeople of any kind.
Plumbers.
There are, people who graduate from high school, most, I think a very, very high, 90-some percent, I believe, graduate from high school, even though compulsory education ends at the end of middle school. That's a given. After high school, there are a number of trade schools, and almost a surprising number of Japanese high school graduates go on to trade schools. I hope I don't undermine sort of everything I've said up until now, but I've asked people from the Ministry of International Trade and Industry, what percentage of Japanese high school graduates go on to a four-year college? And then I say, then add to that the junior colleges. I asked Sumiko, and she said, I shouldn't embarrass her. Some people say, well, let's see, about 70% go to four-year college, and then another 10% maybe to the junior colleges, and then the rest for this trade school. Well, in 1988, it was 26%. Only 26% went to a four-year college, which is in a way, most of whom we've been talking about here. And another 10, that was about right, another 10% went to a junior college. Those are mostly young women to gain some secretarial skills to go into a company. And where are we, 36? 46 or some percent of the students went on to a variety of professional schools and trade schools. And that's where they'll go for 2, 3, or 4 years to gain training in various types of engineering and very, very concrete subjects. And then they'll go on to get a job.
I can see where the creative, if you look at education as being, one of the purposes of education being to better mankind, this kind of system is... it's a problem. You know, if you look at medicine, for example, or areas where there needs to be creativity if we're going to have progress, no advances in medicine have really come out of this kind of a system. Mm-hmm. They've all been, in our country and abroad, they've all come from creative people. And mm-hmm. it's interesting that most of them have been beyond the university level when they make the most contributions.
Yeah, and let me give Tonegawa here. Anybody recognize the name? Year before, he is the Japanese geneticist who received the Nobel Prize. And he was big news in Japan. And the first papers came out, and another Japanese got a Nobel Prize, until it turns out, of course, that he's been working at MIT for 25 years. and not only that, but he's extremely critical of the research and has done so publicly, saying that you can't do anything, any decent research in Japan, and because of something, or I don't know that much about the building trades, but what he says is that the graduate student professor or researcher relationship is the closest thing to feudalism that you see these days. That you can't do anything. All you do is, this is probably not unheard of in the U.S. universities as well, but it's very stifling. It's very stifling, and he couldn't get anything accomplished in Japan, so he did come. Well, you know, one of the things about the standardization of the system, and I'm going to take Sanai, our niece. She came to Poynette, and she blew them away because she knew so much. She knew so much in a number of areas. It's not exactly like that. That's not what I want to say. For example, she probably knew more songs than the American kids. She probably knew more world geography than the American kids. And in many different areas.
What? Probably knew more American.
No, maybe so. Maybe so. The problem with Sanai is, and we love her dearly, is that someone else at her high school, Ochana Mizu, would probably have done just as well and in exactly the same way. Which, what I mean is, even though Sanai knows, say, she learned 20 songs, you know, that she can do very well, the person right next to her in Japan knows the same 20 songs. I mean, these are the 20 songs that the Ministry of Education chose, right? So, what if you get 10 of her Sanai and 9 of her friends in a room, the total is 20 songs. Whereas right. Whereas the American group, they might not have done all that, but you know, if you got 10 of them and each of them know 4, chances are they won't be the same ones. You know, this is the thing of having the same textbooks all over the country, and you get all the efficiency from that. But at the same time, everybody knows that everybody studies the same thing, so that when you get a group of people together, you're sort of the entire scope, the parameters are set here. You know. And that's one of the big problems with this kind of standardization.
Now, the students seem to often have like a more adult attitude than what we consider, you know, a juvenile or childlike approach. It's work instead of play. When they get older, is there any kind of backlash? I mean, are there adults in Japan who rebel? later on, or wants to get in this mode of mistake?
I think it's a mistake to take someone who studies very hard and maybe does well in this test and to assume that this reflects sort of a mature attitude, because the real thing is they do nothing but study. They really have very, very few other social skills. I mean, Sumiko and I joked about the autistic, that's part of it, yeah. That they don't date. And I say all this because it's changing probably as we speak. You know, there are young people who are, Yumiko, I'm cringing over there. all of this is changing. This is why Japan. This is why Japan is a really interesting place. I'm sorry, Dan.
She had more boyfriends than I had girlfriends in high school.
Not hard to believe, Dan.
But you're great.
I mean, of course it's all changing. This is what makes Japan so exciting right now. I mean, this is, I've been describing sort of what they've come up to now, and they realize that there are problems with this.
I just wondered, what does go on at the university? You indicated that once you passed the test and got in, there were 4 years there when you didn't have to study. But what is the curriculum like, and what does in effect go on at Tokyo University?
Let's look at the other. Well, I don't know. I didn't go to. I haven't been to Tokyo University. What I have heard is that there's not much serious study going on there, and the other end of that is that it doesn't make any difference what you study at Tokyo University, because you are hired more on the basis of where you went to school rather than what you studied. We have people in our office who majored in French literature. You know. French literature, but I mean, it really has, it's safe to say, almost no effect what you study in the university. Where they're selecting is at that stage. What school you went to is all important. Here's the one here.
A couple of things. Have I not read, I mean, I think that I've read and heard reports that with the what's happening with the Juku, and how it's kind of destroying itself, if you will, or however you said that at the beginning, that hasn't the suicide rate gone up with the pressure on the kids to study so hard and to get into those schools?
The Ran Yasu agreement that resulted in a study of the Japanese school system by the American side and that was done in 1984, and this is all I have information on. They said in that study that there really was no significant difference in the suicide rate of teenagers in Japan and the United States and Europe, I think.
Well, you know, on a limited basis, probably not as much so. I think the same thing actually is kind of happening in the U.S. with the advent of more and more classes for how to take the SATs, how to improve your scores, which are also becoming very, very expensive for high school students, and of which there's much, much more pressure on now to fit into that norm, to be one of those students who have taken that course, if you will, as to how to get through that. And I think in some respects the same thing is happening. And I've had a couple of Japanese daughters, if you will, for a year or so that have come to study here in the U.S., and the one thing that I've noticed is that they have so much different discipline for studying because of learning how to get through those exams.
Exactly, yeah.
But once they're through them, the same thing that you're saying is that they're then, you know, that's the sort of the hurdle to get over. And then the discipline is still with them because that's become their childhood training. And they, I'm convinced they can memorize well. They know how to study well, but perhaps they haven't had the same training in critical thinking that our American education system likes to put some focus on.
The ideal, I think, I mean, if you really think of it, a guy like Tonegawa is lucky. I mean, and I don't know that much about you. You read how Japanese Americans do so well in the West Coast and other Asians as well. But it seems to me the ideal is a child coming from either Japan or another Asian country, first of all, which places such an emphasis on education to start with, and then also through whatever these systems has developed this persistence, this discipline. And you take that, now, where you might, as you say, if you keep that person in Japan, they might not be able to excel, you know. But you take one of those exceptional people with that discipline and put them into an American school setting, which has some leeway for an exceptional, for an exception, and that's where you can really, where you can really go some, go places. The other side of that coin, you think of what if you did took a really good, a really intelligent American student and sort of supplied him with the Japanese language and put him into a Japanese school. I think you'd get the, you know, the top down. You know, you wouldn't get the excellence that you would get on the side that we just said. You know, there's a Japanese saying, it's the protruding nail that gets hammered down.
But I think one of the basic problems in any any system is, if you have one weight at the top, you distort the whole system. When you have a socialist system, the way to get to the top is to run the government.
Yeah.
When you have in America, you can be very smart or very rich or very talented in sport or a great musician, and they're all ways to the top. Mm-hmm. But in a system like this, there's only one way to the top, and if you don't make it, you're a failure. So there's 40,000 kids that get into Tokyo University, and there are 2 million others are all failures. Whereas in our system, if I don't go to Harvard, but I'm a football player at Washington, or I go to the Juilliard School to study music, I can be a success in lots of different ways. But now we're putting a lot of emphasis on the SATs and stuff, and we're getting into the same problem, that the only way to succeed is that one way.
I heard one guy at Michigan talk about the Japan system. He says, the problem is that there's no loser's bracket.
Yeah.
Once you're done, you're done there.
Yeah.
Dan, go ahead.
Yeah, I was wondering if you could say a little bit about how companies train their new employees, too.
Well, that's another thing. What goes on at Tokyo University. The company in Japan, once they recruit someone who, by getting into the university, has proven that he has a discipline and can work long hours, has stamina, and has sort of mental abilities, that's the kind of person they want. And then the company that's why it makes no difference what he studied. What they want is that kind of person. And then the company goes ahead and gives him the training, gives him or her the training that they want to, that they really want to instill. And much of what goes on in universities, but as well as graduate schools in the United States, is assumed by a Japanese company. Businesses take much more of that responsibility. Mark?
I was going to just say that. I mean, I think it would be interesting in working the experiment in reverse that you mentioned earlier, that taking the Japanese students who acquired this kind of discipline and moving them now to the universities in this country. But what I find interesting about the Japanese system that I wish went on more here was that once you got to the four-year college, that you could study whatever you wanted to. And instead of doing what our students tend to do, which is to try to specialize in the first year, they're very worried whether they should take only business courses or only pre-med courses for some kind of track. And it sounds to me like what you're saying is that people go into Japanese society into all sorts of vocations, regardless of what they study those 4 years.
Yeah, it sounds great to us. But the problem is that the people who slept only 4 hours a night for years to get into Tokyo University and did all this, once they're in there, I mean, that's sort of study in a sense, but it's not the kind of person who all of a sudden, oh, now I'm free and now I can study what I've always wanted to study.